I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The historian Jacques Barzan has built a best-selling conversation around 500 years of European and American civilization, which he believes is coming to an end. He has set his readers in the story of Western culture pretty much the way his own happy Parisian childhood set him in the middle of the French avant-garde in the Cubist decade before World War I. Jacques Barzan was born in 1907. He's in his 93rd year. In his father's house, the young artistic, poetical, and musical geniuses of the early century came and went. Brancusi, Kandinsky, Cocteau, Verres, Ezra Pound, among others. And in Jacques Barzan's crowning work as a writer, the eminences of our history as a civilization, Erasmus of the early Reformation, Calvin of the late, Petrarch of the sonnets, Shakespeare, Rousseau, Berlioz, and Byron, Malthus, and Marx, all enter and exit arguing a new angle about religious belief or human salvation, or about the monarchy and the government of nations, or about the claims of individual freedom, and into the 20th century about economic and social equality. This is the book that the master teacher and biographer Jacques Barzan, among the original cultural historians, worked and waited a very long lifetime to write. His title is From Dawn to Decadence, which invites us to start the argument around the end. Connection listeners, how does he conclude that it's over? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Jacques Barzan, who thinks boredom with our achievement is a kind of key symptom of our time. Had it occurred to you before that been there, done that has become a kind of catchphrase of our civilization? 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection with the historian Jacques Barzan. Welcome, Professor Barzan. What do we mean in this case by decadence?
That's a question frequently asked. The word, I suppose, is frightening and suggests chaos.
Or decay, or a falling off, anyway.
Well, it is falling off. It is the loss of the intention behind an institution or an idea. And when that happens, the institution and the production of any cultural work becomes, in a sense, pointless. It destroys itself. For example, take one of the great creations of Western civilization since 1500, the nation state. It is now coming apart as a result of what we call globalization. One nation suing another in its own court, the European Union telling each of its constituent members what they may or may not do. And in addition to that, all sorts of dissident groups wanting separate institutions. In England, for example, a parliament for Wales, a parliament for Scotland, and in the newer nations, a continual warfare between two or more groups who think that they are the nation. It shows that the idea of the nation, which is coming together and not separatism, is being fallen away from. Another example is contemporary art. When you consider what it was at the beginning of the period, in the Renaissance, with the great discovery of perspective painting, and you see the masterpieces of that time and the things that are now offered us as art, you see that the original idea has been fallen away from.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. Going back to the nation state, and in the age of the Internet, it's not clear exactly what the nation state does or doesn't control. I think it's Daniel Bell's line that the nation state is too big to do the small stuff, too small to do the big stuff. The comparison, I suppose, in your book is with the state of the Catholic Church before this period begins. It was too deep in its own problem to manage it as when the Reformation arrived. Is that the kind of, would you compare sort of the geriatric stiffness of this society with the state of the church in 1500?
Yes, that's a very good comparison. In fact, the whole 15th century was one of decadence in every institution, every idea, and the rise of small groups that said, we are the new idea, and we must get rid of the old. The breakup comes partly from listlessness and boredom, and also from demands that contemporary institutions no longer fulfill.
This is not the same by a long shot as the end of history argument of Francis Fukuyama, I take it.
Oh, not at all. No, history does not stop. And there is continuity. And when the new culture develops at an indefinite time, nobody can predict, it will be found that right now there are all sorts of new starts of which we are not aware, of which, if we are aware, we consider unimportant or trivial or eccentric. Mm. If we knew what the next culture was going to be, it wouldn't be new.
Treat the end of history argument a little bit, if only to distinguish it. Fukuyama's argument really was that the great arguments that fueled sort of modern warfare and cultural evolution had been settled in favor of kind of social democracy and mixed capitalism. That, again, is not your argument.
No, and you can't take any one or two elements and say that anything within them has been settled, or that those two are falling apart and the rest is flourishing. There's only one exception to my belief that we are in a period of decadence, and that is science and technology. That is still going strong, and its practitioners are very happy and cheerful in a way that the rest of us are not. I'm not the only person who has used the word decay or decadence, but in all the references that I've found to the idea, it is usually about a particular thing. For example, some are concerned with the family as an institution, and they say it's falling apart. You cannot define it anymore. It has all sorts of contradictory forms and so on. Other people are talking about art. Still others are talking about the stagnation of what we call democratic representative governments, that opposing parties really are not very different, and neither of them makes much headway with its program, and so on. So separately, there's very much of an awareness of decadence, and I'm only the boy who has put it all together and said, look.
You do say, speaking of the end of history, you do say in this book that the themes of the great Western argument have been worked out, themes of salvation, individualism, authority, equity. Do you really mean that? Do you think that the argument is over, so to speak? I wondered, reading your book, frankly, whatever happened, you write so wonderfully about Luther and Erasmus and the Counter-Reformation, the Council of Trent. Whatever happened to that sort of fundamental argument at the beginning of this civilization, as you describe it, about salvation, right belief, human destiny?
Well, the ideal of emancipation, which I think is the principal one in our 500-year civilization, has worked to its end. Everybody is emancipated to the point where he can do, say, think anything he or she wants. There's no more realm that you can think of, manners, morals and mores, in which the person can claim any more freedom. At the same time, everybody feels oppressed by his neighbor, because his neighbor's individuality and emancipation is oppressive through being what it is. So that is a state of stagnation. One can't go any further to emancipate the individual. So the only thing possible is to redefine what an individual is and what freedom is, which probably means clearer limitations and a realm in which self-control and self-limitation will take effect. But may I suggest that we not stay too long on this point of decadence and falling away, because I should hate to have our listeners think that my book is exclusively about the current self-destruction.
No, it's funny. You beat me to the point. I wanted to emphasize this is an incredibly lively conversation with all sorts of figures and arguments about them. And it's a very, what shall I say? I noticed, for example, you have a little war with Shakespeare and bardolatry throughout this book. I also want to note that Jacques Barzan, true to form, there's a certain French chauvinism that runs through the whole argument. You like Voltaire better than you like Samuel Johnson. You like Berlioz better than you like Beethoven. There are all manner of cultural prejudices and arguments dotted through this narrative in an enormously engaging way. So it's by no means just an essay about the end of anything. I wonder, you know, you speak of so many of these people almost, as I said, as people you met in your father's drawing room. Berlioz, of course, you've written about at great length before. Are there any other particular favorites, though, you want to advocate?
I want first to demur at your suggestion of French chauvinism, and particularly saying that I like Berlioz better than Beethoven. That is simply contrary to the fact of my inner mind and soul. It may be that there were certain characters that I was enthusiastic about, but the enthusiasm doesn't mean exclusivity.
And no, I didn't mean
Voltaire,
that.
Voltaire is a person that I respect much less than much more than I admire. I don't admire Voltaire particularly, and there are people like Walter Bagehot and Samuel Butler, who are both English, who arouse my enthusiasm particularly because they're undervalued and little read, and I make a pitch for them in those little biographies to which you refer within the scope of my book. So apart from that, let me touch on your main question about biographies. I think that history is made up of the actions of human beings. So it is necessary to deal with those who have been influential and whose ideas we still live with and live upon. Hence these, I think, a friend of mine has counted the number, there are 154 little sketches throughout the book.
What's your problem with Shakespeare?
I'm a great admirer of Shakespeare. I read him continually. I just believe that he is by no means the greatest poet who ever lived, which the bardolaters think. I don't think that the industry that has grown up around Shakespeare is good for Shakespeare or for the idea of a playwright and poet at all. And I make the point that there are really two Shakespeares, the one who lived and wrote in the 16th and early 17th centuries, and this creation of the bard, which is an affectation of the 19th century. Furthermore, I think that the current handling of Shakespeare is outrageous. He is, as it were, brought up to date in the most fantastic way, a travesty very often of his ideas, of his intention, of his mood, of his tone. It has gone so far that somebody has rewritten. Mr. Rouse has produced Shakespeare in his own idiom, which I think is idiotic.
Well, the new Ethan Hawke movie that we've been enjoying is all, of course, it's set in Manhattan today, but it's all premised on the notion, I suppose, that Shakespeare is ever and always for all time. He's the sort of scripture of this culture. You think Ben Jonson was a better poet, but I mean, would you?
No. I never said that. No.
Did you not at the book?
No. Oh, Shakespeare is a far greater poet than Ben Jonson and a greater dramatist. I merely said, and this is what misled you, that throughout the 17th century, after Shakespeare's death, and part of the 18th, Ben Jonson was considered the far greater poet because he was classical. He obeyed the rules that people thought were laid down by Aristotle in Grecian times. No.
You locate that by the bardolatry in the 1830s in a way, but it may have reached a kind of high watermark with Harold Bloom and his appreciation of Shakespeare for the invention of the human, as he writes.
I make the same point without having read Mr. Bloom in a different way. Montaigne first and Shakespeare next invented character, that is to say, the figure in a play or a novel who is complex, who is not a type, who repeats the same trait or tendency of action or thought throughout. We, as human beings, know our friends and acquaintances only as types. It takes a novelist or a playwright like Shakespeare to develop character, that is, the inconsistencies, the variability that we know now to be a human fact, but which literature had really not dealt with before Shakespeare. And I mention Montaigne first because it's quite clear that the translation of Montaigne's essays into English by Fleuriot influenced Shakespeare. He is known to have read Fleuriot because he quotes him in two or three of the plays word for word at considerable length. I'm sure that Shakespeare's invention of character was independent. He found Montaigne probably a confirmation of his great vision, the vision of human character.
You sketch so many sort of emblematic intellectual, poetic, artistic figures of this civilization, Jacques Barzan, in this marvelously written book, I must say. I wonder, in a period that you define as decadent, at the end of this time, is there a representative intellectual figure for you of our time, of these sort of end times of Western civilization?
I find it difficult to name such a person because it seems to be a part of the idea of falling away that nobody can be representative or great in the sense of synthetic, of bringing together all the elements of a live society and fusing them into a great work. The last figure whom I consider approaching or perhaps occupying such a role is Ortega y Gasset, who died before the full symptoms of decadence became visible.
Ortega Egasset, the revolt of the masses. Why, emblematic of what?
He saw what was going on. He virtually predicted the state of decadence. He united in his works on history, liberty, education, and the book you refer to, The Revolt of the Masses. He brought together all the elements that he thought were the leading ones of our society, and gave a critique of their nature and probable consequences.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the historian and meta-historian Jacques Barzan. His new book, a crowning work, his 29th or 30th book of history, is called From Dawn to Decadence, 500 Years of Western Cultural Life. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Barzan connection. Philip is on the line.
Yes, good morning, Professor. I spent the weekend at a university with grad students in the sciences, and we had conversations just two nights ago where no one knew the meaning of most major dates, at least in this country. 1776, they were slightly confused. What was that? Was that the Civil War? Was that... No one knew basic history, and these were students who were doctoral candidates in microbiology, medicine, infectious diseases. I was shocked at their lack of knowledge, and they gave it back to me that, well, you don't know much about what we do. While I don't, I feel that, as you said, the sciences are thriving. They're thriving, but they're thriving in a vacuum. And do you have any thoughts on how, and I'm reminded of, was it Snow's Two Cultures, but how in, with the technology at the level it is for the sciences, these people are moving at, with vast amounts of money at very high levels of technology and understanding of basic things, biology, microbiology. What realm are they in when it comes to culture?
Interesting question. Jacques Barzan, do you have an answer?
They lack a general culture, but so do everybody else. The schools, primary, secondary, and colleges and universities, are largely responsible for the falling away from the notion of a general education. At the present time, it's only the smallest colleges that provide a liberal arts program, and it is not even always required. In the lower schools, history was given up quite a while ago in favor of social studies, which is a nondescript, incoherent kind of subject that most people who teach it are not equipped to teach, and they certainly don't know much history. There are all sorts of social and accidental reasons for that state of affairs, but it's pretty generally agreed that the public school, not only in the United States, but all over the Western world, has failed. It has completely fallen apart. And its defects have gone up into the higher education, which now is full of subject matter that does not contribute to a general education. Particular topics dealing with minorities or with other cultures than our own, or with such things as photography, making film, and so on. So we are not to wonder that there is no general culture anymore for anybody.
Can I just observe that there are several questions tied up in that? First of all, I wonder, reading your book, how you learned what you learned. You not only learned the history, but you, throughout the book, whether it's Petrarch or Rabelais or Montaigne, Pascal, Ben Jonson, Rousseau, Bach, you know the work you mastered the material and the joy of the material in itself. The second question Philip makes me wonder is, I mean, the problem is partly that the people who do know what happened in 1776 tend not to know, as C.P. Snow said, what the second law of thermodynamics is all about. But I think Philip's real question is, can a scientific culture, which is robust and happy and cheerful, as you say, Jacques Barzan, can it live on its own energy? Can it live without this historical connection? Maybe is that the sign of its future possibility?
In general, culture has a unifying effect, just as patriotism has a unifying effect on the citizen in the nation state. And as we said earlier, the nation state is falling apart and new loyalties and allegiances are taking place. Similarly, culture is breaking up into all sorts of local, historical, ethnic activities, which are not the elements of general culture.
I have to interrupt you for a short break. Yes. Jacques Barzan, we'll be right back. This is The Connection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest is Jacques Barzan. His new 800-page history, From Dawn to Decadence, is a remarkably lively, intimate, opinionated conversation in and around the great men and women of Western civilization. The argument at the end, though, is that it's over. The phone's 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK. And yet you say, Professor Barzan, that it's remarkable how happy and cheerful the scientific and technological world still is. Can that world sustain itself on its own self-confidence?
I imagine it can. And whatever may happen to the political, social, economic institutions that the future holds in store, they will certainly be hospitable to science and technology, since they now condition our life in a way that seems irreversible. Mm. But we were talking about the importance and the character of general culture, and when that is the subject, one thinks always of great works. But I would point out that popular culture is also all broken up into specialties. What we call pop art, pop music, is a collection of any number of separate things with separate audiences. There is no unity, cultural unity, on the popular level any more than there is on the high level. Another indication that we are in a state of falling away, falling apart, decadence. So what will be recreated, let us say, in the future state of regions rather than national states, nobody can tell. But probably the smaller scale of the region will produce a genuine popular culture that expresses the people as a whole, and instead of a group of persons who are fed fairly mechanically organized pieces of work under any of these names, such as rock and roll, jazz, hip-hop, all the explosive musics that we now have.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Jacques Barzan. For many, many years at Columbia University, the author of all manner of work, including Teacher in America, two-volume biography of Hector Berlioz. His new book, From Dawn to Decadence, is a sweeping and extraordinarily lively and personal history of 500 years of Western civilization. Wasim is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Great show.
Welcome. Thank you.
My question for the professor is that the word decadence has a certain moralistic tang to it. And as we know, morals and mores, they come and go. But as long as there's this creative ferment in a civilization, as long as it's progressing technologically, if I may say so, does the professor think that that's our insurance against decadence and decay?
Professor Barzan.
Yes. Creative is a weasel word. we use it to honor and express admiration for work beautifully done, great work. But also, we use it merely for the activity of making something. And no doubt, science and technology are making all sorts of wonderful things. But if one looks carefully at two different periods, say the early 20th century and our time, one notices a great difference, which is that at the earlier time, all sorts of new grand ideas in science and technology were being produced, whereas now we are developing those ideas in all sorts of directions. But the methods, the underlying assumptions, the principles of each of the sciences have been set for us, and we're not creating anything really new in the domain of scientific thought.
Can I challenge you on that? Can I challenge you on that? At least the implications. I mean, in very large terms, the breakthroughs we talk so much about these days, the Genome Project, which talk about inventing the human. I mean, opens up centuries of re-examination and rethinking about what it is to be human. The electronic culture, the internet, certainly makes the reality of a world consciousness something entirely new. And also, it seems to me, the breakthroughs in astronomy, in the understanding of the whole universe of creation, are enormously, whether they're brand new technologies, they have embedded in them huge philosophical questions about who we are and what we're up to. I don't think those are small refinements. And I also raise a question about sort of whether this civilization is ending or reconstituting itself in a new way. What about, where do you place the discovery, say, of the genome and of the internet and of the universal pictures of the, you know, astronomy?
You're speaking about the effects, the consequences
Yep.
of these scientific activities and breakthroughs. But we must remember that the groundwork, so to speak, is Einstein and Bohr and all the thinkers who fought out relativity and quantum theory, Rutherford and the constitution of the atom, de Vries and genetics, Weismann and genetics. And genetics goes back to Gregor Mendel in the 1860s. What I was talking about was the difference between the great ideas which lead the way to such scientific results as the genome and the astrophysics of our time. That's a radical difference in the meaning of science, so to speak. And I certainly don't want to belittle any scientific activity, but one could say that we have been fiddling with the consequences of those great activities. We are in our little workshop dealing with this and with that according to the leading lights and ideas that were created nearly 100 years ago. You probably won't agree, but I stick to my guns.
Okay. 1-800-423-8255. Jake is on the line.
Hi, Professor. It's an honor to speak to you. I was wondering, when I listened to your arguments about decadence, I was reminded by the way in which Anthony Giddens, the director of the London School of Economics, defines globalization in his Rice lectures and his book Runaway World. I'm wondering if you think that this era of decadence is the end of something, or is globalization the next 500 years, the next new thing, or is this the end of this era?
Great question, Jake. Thank you.
No problem.
Decadence has the function, historical function, of clearing the ground for novelty. Novelty has a hard time until there is a void to be filled. So we should, in a way, cheer at decadence and make it go as fast as possible. Decadences can last a generation or a century or several centuries. So there is no reason to weep and deplore and resist. Certainly not resist. We should cheer everything that looks as if the ground was being cleared in this or that sector. Now, as to globalization and the Internet, those are not in themselves cultural. They're instruments. They're not cultural substance. Globalization can carry any kind of message or purpose, and so can the Internet. And the present chaos on the Internet, which has been talked about frequently in recent years, is an indication that we haven't got a line, a direction, for the production, the creation of a new cultural era.
You know, can I just throw in a name, a modern French name that you don't include in your book, but that's the Jesuit scientist Teilhard de Chardin. He had a notion that, in fact, I mean, this was 50 years ago, long before the Internet came over the horizon, but that he foresaw an evolutionary leap toward a global thinking consciousness, which some people feel has been fulfilled by the Internet, but it is a major step. And it seems to me maybe charts the way out of this decadence, or it's a kind of idea that could chart the way out. What do you think?
I think that we use the word globalization relatively to the former separateness of nations of the West, mainly. But if you really read the paper without preconception, you see that a great portion of the globe, China, Africa, even the Middle East, are involved in cultural activity, cultural wars that have absolutely nothing to do with the Western contribution of technology and the idea of democracy. Democracy is having a very hard time in the Third World and other portions of the globe. We're very far from having common preconceptions about human life, about religion, about marriage, about the treatment of children and women. We're very, very far from a common culture all over the world.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Dawn to Decadence connection with Professor Jacques Barzon. Tom is on the line.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? Listen, I was curious about how he feels that the deleterious effects, he hasn't quite placed it like that, but where I see in what might be called a decadence is that we've inherited belief systems from various millennia through religion, nationalism, war, all these things, and that perhaps the next 500 years, through the use of science and technology as a new way of thinking, I know that this thinking has been taking place for the past 500 years, starting with Newton and maybe people before that, but it's never really been in place as a cultural artifact, respected as a way of being. And I'm not saying that it's going to replace religion or belief. And when I say religion or belief, I mean any kind of thinking that entails the magical or something which cannot be...
Sharpen the question, Tom.
All right. Does he feel, Mr. Bazan, do you feel that religion and other belief systems are what is causing the decadence because people are elevating belief now beyond substance and fact? And you see this, like, in our country with the evolutionary wars and other countries where people...
Tom, give the professor a chance.
Okay, there you go.
If you think that science creates a common consciousness which gets rid of all sorts of superstitions and even of religion, that may well be true, although not all scientists share the same belief. But even supposing that they do, the way of science, the methods and activities of science have not seeped into the common consciousness. As was mentioned by another questioner earlier this hour, we don't know enough about science to think scientifically. We simply owe an awe at some of the results insofar as they're interpreted for us in the newspaper.
Tom, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Jacques Barzan. Patrick is on the line.
Hello. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Patrick.
Professor Barzan, it has seemed to me that the seminal event of the last 500 years was the theft of three entire continents from their indigenous peoples. In North and South America, it's the best estimates I've found are that over 200 million people were killed, Indians, through war, starvation, and primarily European diseases, and about 50 million just right here in the United States. And the gains are that the Europeans took back, the early explorers, took back concepts of personal freedom, self-governance that were later used to overthrow many of the monarchies in Europe. But the losses, I mean, over 200 million and wonderful cultures here in the Americas are extraordinary as well. And I was just wondering, how do you equate those two? And it would seem to me that the concept of decadence as a clearing certainly pertains to the entire 500-year period.
That seems to me a little extreme, and it overlooks the nature of human history. Western civilization didn't get born overnight. It was a result of innumerable invasions from the East into Western Europe, destroying one culture after another. The thousand years of the Roman Empire are the story of those invasions and those destructions. And what went on in this continent and what went on in the Far East was simply a continuation of this human activity, which we may deplore, and we can count up the losses, as you have just done quite rightly, but we cannot undo the past and say that the evil began 500 years ago. And one sign of this is that when the West did begin to give up the places that you call theft or robbery, the native populations began to fight each other. And there were, what was it, when India was liberated, 500 million deaths or something of that order. And what we have seen in China and Korea and all of Africa shows that fighting and grabbing land and destroying culture as well as people is simply an historical continuum.
Patrick, thank you for the question. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the historian Jacques Barzan and his book, From Dawn to Decadence. Chris is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Chris. Welcome.
Thank you. This is an interesting show, Chris. Professor, I was wondering if maybe you're mistaking decadence and confusing it maybe with decentralization, that decentralization of power and learning and culture and these things that I would say is the real meaning and power behind the internet. I mean, not just the technology, but the fact that individuals in these smaller countries, smaller ethnicities, smaller religions can communicate. And that seems to me a far cry from decadence. I mean, that's a kind of enrichment of culture.
Chris, give Jacques Barzan a chance.
There may possibly be an enrichment of individual possession of knowledge or culture or friendships or whatever the person who surfs the internet is interested in. But the decentralization is going pretty far to the extent that it's extremely hard to get anything done anywhere. If you examine, for example, business activity, a transaction which used to be done in a week or 10 days now may take 2 years. If somebody wants to build on a piece of property within a large city, the regulations and the required permits may take from 2 to 4 years. We are in a condition of stasis in many, many ways. And I think that some of the current feeling of general hostility directed at nobody in particular, but at everything in general, is a result of the sense of oppression. And the oppression comes from the failure of institutions to serve our need. And that's all that I call decadence.
Professor Barzan, part of the problem is that we don't read enough books like yours, and we lose touch in a way with the pleasure and the vitality of all those folk that you know too well. I just wonder, do you despair that European culture has lost its authority in the world, that people really mean it in a certain sense about those dead white males? What's to be saved here?
Oh, I refuse the word despair. Far from it. The historian who sees a condition of decadence does not despair. He simply looks forward to what will happen when things have been cleared away, not only in a practical, material sense, such as we've been describing, but also in the minds of the individual. We have to clear out our minds of all sorts of very fine, very good things. And I think that's why, for example, so many productions of classical plays are travesties and the very opposite of what the author intended. For example, there was a production that I saw of Mozart's Don Giovanni, in which the hero was in a wheelchair all the way through the two acts. Mm. Now, that is just the opposite of Don Juan, isn't it?
Well, it sounds close enough. There are just too many pleasures in this book for 1 hour, but it's an enormous privilege and pleasure to have you on The Connection, Professor Jacques Barzan. The book is From Dawn to Decadence, 1500 to the President, to the present, 500 years of Western cultural life. Thank you, Jacques Barzan. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to the latest news, an apology from the Hartford Courant, as the Connecticut paper apologizes for...